Welcome to The Science of Sex, a podcast about the ins and outs of the latest research about everyone's favorite topic. Here's Dr. Jana, an NYU professor of human sexuality, and Joe, a guy who's a fan of sex.
Numero 50.
This is the big 50.
Wow. Welcome to episode 50 of the Science Sex Podcast. How are you, Dr. Jana?
I'm doing great.
So for episode 50, who do you have lined up? This has to be a special guest, right? If it's episode 50, right?
He is a special guest because we were buddies at Cornell.
Okay.
And he's also pretty special because I think this is the first person we are having on the show who's going to talk about trans issues, right?
We've never had a guest.
Okay. So, see, he's special. Okay. We have Dr. Seth Pardo, who works at the San Francisco Department of Public Health and works on trans stuff, and he's going to talk to us about a study he published on the kind of gender identity and gender experience of folks who are gender nonconforming but assigned female at birth.
So that's Seth Pardo coming up. And I know you have one appearance you want to talk about before we get going, Dr. Jana, but we keep getting messages on our social media and info@sciencesexpodcast.com about your favorite Lalo sex toys.
Are we?
Yeah, so you've covered three, and now it's the fourth of the fourth part segment of Dr. Jana's favorite Lalo sex toys. So can we get to it right away? Because people are waiting. They're scoring at home. They want to know. Tell us all, Dr. Jana, that fourth favorite sex toy available at Lalo.com.
Okay. I will. It's called the Tor. And I think it's the Tor 2 at this point that they have. And it's a vibrating cock ring.
Oh.
I think they call it a couples ring or something on the
couples
site.
Ring, yes.
I think it sounds, maybe a little better, more acceptable to some people than a cock ring.
Cock ring,
but
yeah.
Really, it's a cock ring. It's a vibrating thing that you put around the penis, and then you can use it with whoever it is that you are playing with, whether it's the vaginas or anuses that you insert that penis in. But I love it because it provides all the good benefits of a cock ring, which is kind of keep the blood in, once the blood rushes into the penis, and then a cock ring can kind of keep it in there. So it gives it a little tightness. Some guys really like that, and some guys really don't like it. They feel if something is constricting them around the base of the penis, then it really doesn't feel good. So like they'll choose condoms that don't constrict a lot and all that. But there are many guys who really love the feeling of kind of firmness and keeping things in place kind of thing, keeping the blood in place that the cock ring provides. And then this one actually vibrates. It's a vibrator, so it provides all the goodness of the vibration.
So hence a couple's ring, because only is the man getting tied up.
Well, both people can feel it, both the wearer and the receptive partner, because when you're doing penetrative sex, you can have the in and out, but you can also kind of have a more grinding kind of sex, right? Grinding kind of penetration where you get it all the way in, and then instead of in and out, that kind of up and down or back and forth a little bit more kind of grindy motion. And when you do that, pretty much the entire time, this cock ring is going to be in contact, not just with the penis. And it's also for the penis wearer, it's not just the penis. It's also the perineum, right? The area under the balls and the balls and that whole area. And then it's also going to come in contact with the receptive partner. And if you're doing the grinding thing, then it's going to constantly be in contact with the receptive partner and provide a lot of really fun and pleasurable vibration.
Wow. So it turns your penis into like a drill, essentially, because you have...
I would not...
No?
No, I would not bring up that imagery at all. So people, if you can delete this from your mind.
Okay, all right, got it. Because I'm just thinking like of something that's pointy and vibrating to me,
I'm picturing
a drill.
The whole penis is not vibrating.
No, I'm just... Oh, it's okay. It's not... All right, the penis is like... No, okay. Got it.
All right,
good.
You seem to be picturing a fucking machine.
Yes.
That does exist.
Okay.
And some people are really into that.
All right.
But for many people, the fucking machine idea is not exactly a sex drill.
Okay.
I don't know.
Got it. Sorry.
But to some people, it is totally a thing, but that's not what this cock ring does.
All right, good. Thank you.
So
I appreciate you clearing that up. So this is not you're tearing your penis into a sex drill. Good to know.
This is not turning your penis into a sex drill.
All right, cool. That is the Tor 2, and it is available at Lalo.com.
Yes, it is. And you can get it for 20% off, just like you can get anything on Lalo.com for 20% off if you use our discount code, which is science.
And before we get Seth Pardo on the blower here, tell us about the appearance you have coming up.
Oh, so I have an interesting appearance coming up on December 6th at The Assemblage. We've talked about that space here in New York City. And this one is called Doctor's Orders.
It sounds like, is this an adult film? What is this?
It is. No, it's actually less kinky than my normal appearances.
Okay.
I'm getting together with three other doctors, a neuroscientist, a sports medicine doctor, and a biologist. And we're going to debate life's big questions. We're going to provide different perspectives from our different, you know, respective disciplines on some of these big, interesting questions that people might have.
So you'll be handling probably the sex questions. You probably won't
No. But that's the thing. No, each of us is going to answer the same question.
Really?
Yeah, from our perspective. Why are you so dubious about this?
No, you got a biologist on there. What are you going to talk about, you know?
Like, no, but we're not. The questions are not like biology question or sex question. They can be. They're more general questions.
Okay.
They're general questions.
All right.
That can be answered in different ways because we all have different things that we think are important or should be emphasized, and so you're going to get a more holistic perspective.
Got it.
On these questions, because you're going to get the same ones answered by four different people from four different disciplines.
So just so you know, if I had a question about photosynthesis, I'd probably go to the biologist.
Oh my God, we're not going to be answering. I don't think that counts as life's big questions.
Really?
No. So that would not make it on the list of questions for that day.
All right. I guess I have to Google it about photosynthesis.
You're just refusing to accept the premise of this event, aren't you?
No, just, you know, I was just trying to figure out how it works. That's all. So no photosynthesis questions for part of the panel. All right, Dr. Jana, please tell us about today's guest.
Today we have Dr. Seth Pardo with us, who's going to talk to us about a new study of his that is scheduled to get published in the International Journal of Transpersonal Psychology, which is on the gender identity and gender presentation of gender nonconforming folks who were assigned female sex at birth.
Okay.
It's a sample of about 170 folks who were all assigned female at birth, but then as adults identify as something other than or just generally gender nonconforming.
Got it.
And so he went in and looked at, who are these people? What are their gender identities? What is their gender presentation? How do they think about their gender? What words do they use and all that? So we're going to delve deep into gender today.
All right. So who is this guy, Seth Pardo?
Oh, Seth Pardo is actually someone I did my PhD together with.
Oh, okay.
He was there at the Cornell University lab that I became a part of. When I got there, he was in his first or second year, and that's how we met. He was doing research on trans stuff. I was doing research on casual sex. So he got his PhD from the developmental psych program at Cornell University, just like I did. And he is now a lead evaluator and researcher with the San Francisco Department of Public Health. So he chose not to go into academia, but to go into public policy. He is now a recognized researcher, program evaluator, and transgender health specialist, active with educating providers, early career professionals, and students on social determinants of health for people with trans-lived experiences. He's considered a subject matter expert on transgender health and has a long history of developing innovative ways to move cultural competence from abstract ideas to implementing best practices. So, Dr. Seth Pardo, welcome to the Science of Sex podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So, you got your PhD at Cornell in developmental psych, just like I did, and then decided not to go into tenure track academia, which is kind of the standard path that a lot of us take, especially from some of these research-based schools. That's all they teach us how to do, is to go into tenure track academia. And I obviously made a different choice, but so did you. So tell us about that. Why and how did you not go into tenure track, and how did you end up at the San Francisco Department of Public Health instead?
So
The short version of it.
The short version is, in many cases, at the time that we were coming out onto the academic scene was right around the time that the economy was really poor. Mm. It was right after 2008 economic meltdown, and the job opportunities were not as prevalent as they were prior to that. And universities were taking a different approach to how many tenure track lines they were having. Mm. So the choices were not as plenty. And work was not the most important thing in my life. My life is the most important.
How dare you say that?
I know. Oh my God. A lot of people, not everyone, but a lot of people that I knew in academia, their work was the center of their world.
Right.
And for me, it was a piece of a much bigger circle. Mm. So my life as a whole was not centered around my research, although it had a lot of influence on my research. And a lot of my life was happening outside of the school and was really bringing me towards a community and a society that was very much here based in the Bay Area in San Francisco. A lot of my work was centered around trans health and medical decision making in trans communities. And there was a lot of support for trans populations here in the Bay Area. And so I came out here to the Bay Area. I did a postdoc in a clinical program that was a research postdoc, but associated with a clinical program. And mm-hmm. I had been toying with the idea of adding the clinical specialization to my training anyway. So I came out here for the postdoc. Things just happened, and I found myself following a path of research that led me to the Department of Public Health, where I was doing what I loved for a community that is a part of me and is a part of my people. And I just thought this is the best case scenario. I get to do research in a community that is predominantly people of color who are underserved, who really don't have a whole lot of voice in the literature. Mm. And I really wanted to serve that community more. And I just had an opportunity to do it at the Department of Public Health, and I grabbed it.
What specifically do you get to do in the Department of Public Health in San Francisco?
I do program evaluation and research in behavioral health services. I'll meet with the clinics and programs that serve clients in behavioral health or mental health services, and I'll interview the clients, I'll interview the staff, and ask them what's working, what's not working, and how can we do this better? And so I work with both the community-based organizations, those that provide regular mental health services or general mental health services in the community, as well as specialty programs such as Gender Health SF or intensive case management programs.
And so in addition to all of this work, you've kind of kept publishing in the academic literature, even though that's probably not required as part of your job at the public health department, right?
Right. So publishing is not required as part of my job, but I love to do it. I love to share knowledge. I can't help myself.
All right. Let's talk about the study that is coming out. Is IMPRESS, right, currently?
It's IMPRESS.
Okay.
The last I heard from the journal, it should be out sometime this winter, so probably early 2019.
And it is about sort of the gender identity and the gender experience of gender nonconforming folks who were assigned female sex at birth.
That's right.
And there are a lot of terms in there that for a lot of people are like, what is all that? So, and we've talked a little bit about on the podcast, especially in this current climate with the Trump administration trying to write trans folks out of existence and all that. So we did cover some of the differences between biological sex and gender and all that. But let's kind of do that again for the purposes of this conversation. So let's just start with, you know, the differences between sex and gender. And then I want to talk a little bit about more specific language that you're using in the paper and that we're using more generally to talk about trans experiences.
So when I say sex versus gender, here's what I mean. Sex being more of this biologically rooted status of male or female in a traditional sense. So my view of sex is inclusive of more than just two, to include those who have intersex conditions or disorders of sex development that make it unclear. It's not just male or just female, right? That there are gradations in between.
So in opposition to these biological sex, which is a combination of chromosomes, hormones, hormone receptors, external and internal genitals, all of which will determine this biological sex, we have the concept of gender, which is a little more complicated,
yes.
Even more complicated than the concept of sex.
Only complicated in the sense that there are fewer, more biological measures or metrics for such a definition, but still, in my opinion, as a developmental psychologist who studies trans identities, for me, it's not that complicated. That, you know, gender is more of these trait characteristics and behaviors that we more culturally associate with sex. So roles, stereotypes, presentation, like dress styles, expressions of masculinity and femininity, all of the behavioral and social labels that we assign or associate with what we consider to be an essentialist view of beinghood through sex, the more biological view, I view gender as sort of the frosting on the cupcake. It's it's all the stuff that we share outwardly as an expression, the traits and behaviors that we express to others.
Right.
Now, there are people who take issue with that, that it's not just the outward expression. Some people say, well, my gender is how I view my selfhood as separate from my biology. And that's still like within the realm of gender for me as well. That's where it starts to, where language starts to get a little blurry.
Right. But that's when, I mean, that's the aspect of gender that's about your own identity, right? As opposed to some of these other kind of more maybe societal expectations or roles or whatever. And it's all mixed in. You have the identity as well as the roles and norms that you have internalized about what you think should be the behavior or the appearance or the personality of someone with whatever gender identity you identify as. So it's all it's all mixed in.
My approach is trying to look at the whole person. I really think that it's important not to separate an individual, in particular when studying trans communities and non-binary communities. For me, it's important not to separate the individual from pieces of themselves, to look at their identities as a whole, to look at their lives as a whole, and see what can we learn from taking different approaches to studying how they view themselves as a whole.
And the first thing I want us to kind of discuss and define is some of the language that is being used. So let's just kind of define some of these things.
Okay. Because, gender nonconformity would be anything that is outside of what society deems stereotypic of a certain gender or a certain sex.
So that's like an umbrella term.
Yes, gender nonconformity is somewhat of an umbrella term. And there are trans people who transition in their lives, who seek out medical interventions to bring their identities in alignment with their bodies, or to bring their bodies in alignment with their identities. But they may actually, so like a trans man who was assigned female at birth, who accesses medically necessary services to change his body to be in alignment with his identity as a man or as male, can be stereotypically masculine or can behave in a more non-conforming expression of gender.
Right. So gender nonconformity is about the expression. It's not about your gender identity, the internal experience of your own gender, but it's, are you kind of conforming to the expectations that society has about what boys are supposed to be like or men, or what are girls supposed to be like, and are you behaving in that way? And so you can have gender nonconforming people whose gender identities are not trans, right?
Nailed it.
Right, you can have a self-identified woman who was assigned female at birth, so everything is in line. She's cisgendered, but she's just a tomboy, right?
Right,
and does things that are typically masculine or wears things that are typically masculine. So that's the gender nonconformity. And as you were saying, you can have trans folks who are pretty conforming, their now existing gender identity and body that was brought in alignment.
That's right.
So gender nonconformity. Broad term, umbrella term for all kind of behavior or appearance that
outside of the stereotype norm.
Right. For that gender. Okay.
Right.
Trans versus cis. Is that, Joe, do you think
I think that's,
we got
pretty,
that?
That one's pretty safe. I think we got that one safe. the one I'm always confused with, and I hate to say it incorrectly. So what's the difference between a trans woman and a trans man? Like, which is which? Is the trans man the one who was born a woman? And then I just don't know what the order of it is there, Seth.
Yeah. I mean, the easiest way to remember it is the label that you actually end up using in the identity is the identified gender. So if someone has an identity as a trans woman, they identify as a woman with a trans lived experience. So they were likely assigned male at birth.
Got it.
And identify as a woman. And in some cases, they keep that trans part as an important part of their identities. And so they identify as trans women. There are trans women who don't keep the trans part in their identity label, and they're just women.
Got it.
And I'm actually glad you're asking these questions, because a lot of people have them. And one thing to think about is you would never call a trans woman a man.
That's right.
Because what she is now, that is that's the noun that you would be using to describe her. That's right. She is a woman. And if there's trans, that means, you know, she was assigned male at birth. Now, the born woman, that's another thing that we should probably talk about, some of these terms that are okay and not okay to use these days, right? Because the language has been changing. So there are some terms that have been thrown around in the past that have been used to describe. So I think natal sex, or, you know, as Joe said, born a man and that kind of stuff. Nowadays, we talk about assigned sex at birth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Any other?
Yeah. I was listening to you say this, and it struck me that nobody's born a man.
Right. Exactly.
You're born, and yay, you have a healthy baby. One of the first questions people ask is it a boy or a girl?
Mm.
Well, we have reduced our existence to just two sexes, male.
Right, exactly. And it's not a boy. It's not going to be a boy until that child identifies as a boy, right?
And a lot of people are going to go, nah, that's a lot of bunk. Like, come on, you know, if you're just a boy, right? Mm. But when we're born, we're too young to say for ourselves how we understand ourselves to be.
Right, because boy, girl, man, woman, those are gender identity terms, or gender terms in general. And until you have that identification, which starts around age 3 or so, right, when we start to identify our own gender, understand our own gender, until then, it's not really a boy or a girl. Although you could certainly talk about being male or female, or at least being assigned male or female sex.
Right. It goes back to the original conversation, because a lot of people can't differentiate between sex and gender.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a whole, you know. So
well, that's what we're trying to do. Trying to educate and give people the language necessary to understand these differences and be able to communicate and discuss some of these things in ways that are appropriate and not hurtful or offensive to folks whose gender and sex. Because, right, for the vast majority of us, gender and sex are in this very simple alignment, right? And so it doesn't matter which one you use.
And we don't think about it.
Well, and I think now too, Seth, me, for instance, I try to overthink it, you know, asking the trans women question. Now I just want to make sure I don't say the wrong thing to a person, you know what I mean? So I think, and like you said, there's so many different labels and ways to say it. I think a lot of people are just afraid to offend people. Mm-hmm. So they're always, you know, and I know the easiest thing to do is, how would you like me to refer to you, or something like that. So how does someone who is not as educated as you people, how do you suggest they should live their lives in terms of interacting with people who are trans or trans women, trans men?
Here's the simplest example. Hi, what's your name? Right? So I don't ever walk up to somebody on the sidewalk and say, what are you?
Right. Okay.
I mean, that's just rude.
Yes.
Right? And it happens all the time, because somebody feels like they can't figure it out. So is it really yours to figure? It's not yours to figure out. It's just be kind. You know, if you're approaching somebody in society, first of all, why do you need to know so badly how they quote unquote identify? And if you really want to interact with that person, you just say, hi, my name is Joe, or my name is Seth. What's your name? And they'll tell you. If their name is Jane, then that's how you refer to them.
Right.
And
but it's...
if you're talking about them, then, you know, if you want to refer to them in the third person and they happen to be standing next to you and you want to use some pronouns, you can turn to them and say, you know, I never really asked you, what pronouns do you use? You know, you're not saying, I can't figure out your pronouns, so tell me. It's really a genuine, respectful approach to say, oh, you know, I was talking with a friend the other day, and I realized I never really asked you what pronouns you use.
Right.
Oh, I'm glad you asked. I don't use pronouns. I use they. I use my name. Or I use she, or I use he. And you know, it opens up a very respectful conversation in that way. And I'm really interested to hear perhaps more from you, Joe, about, like, what is it that other questions that do come up around this? Because this is an excellent opportunity to share with more than just we three what would be the best way to do that?
Well, I think a lot of it, and I hate to say it became mainstream, but I mean, really transgender, the idea of it became mainstream over the last 3 or 4 years, you know, with the Caitlyn Jenner situation and the, you know, the TV show Transparent. So up until a few years ago, I think I've learned more over the last couple of years than I had, you know, in the other 40 years on my on the planet. And I think I could probably speak for a
discussed.
Lot of people.
It was not discussed. Absolutely, yeah.
So how do you feel, Seth, in terms of your career? Because you say you've been doing this for 10 years. How were the first five compared to the last five?
You know, I'm really glad to see greater visibility mm-hmm. about trans individuals in popular culture. Mm-hmm. That's lovely. For better or worse, it's nice to see it in, you know, Netflix shows. It's nice to see it in, you know, the general media. It's nice to see it represented now in our elected officials. I'm just thrilled with the second half of that decade compared to the first half of the decade. I can tell you that there were, you know, even in academia is a little slower than popular culture, but it's still pretty difficult to publish some of this work in mainstream journals, in mainstream American Psychological Association journals. Some individuals feel like this isn't a good fit for my journal. Mm. That's okay. I mean, things will eventually shift and change as society becomes more tolerant and accepting, not just tolerant, but accepting of trans individuals. But just draw back to, like, you know, way back in the 70s mm-hmm. and 80s and probably even still in the early 90s, which isn't that long ago. No. I say way back relative to my life.
Yeah.
Where if you didn't know somebody who was gay, then it was this community of people who were other. And they were strange and unknown and to some scary because we didn't know anything about them. It's the same thing here. When you don't know somebody in the community, you don't know somebody who's trans. They're just this big gaping hole of unknown. Mm. And we find the unknown to be scary. Mm. But the more we know people and the more that we see trans people in our societies and we realize, oh, they're people just like me. Then they're less scary. And when they're less scary, they're less intimidating. When they're less intimidating, we don't have to fight so hard to put them down.
Yeah. And I mean, in general, I think we can try to do our best to educate. And the language is changing and the concepts and how we understand some of these things are changing. And so, you know, we do our best to stay on top of some of those changes and be open to being corrected if we have made a mistake. You know, that's also Yeah. Part of learning and being open to listening to what those changes are. And I think, you know, in general, some ways that we can be cognizant of that when talking about things that are not specific to a specific person or something, not using he or she pronouns right, you know, immediately, but using something like they when you don't know the gender of the person that, or you're not sure and such, and also using terms. So, and Seth, I also want to bring up some of the terms that at this point are probably not okay, not considered appropriate to use to describe trans folks that may have been okay to use during some previous times. So these days we use trans woman, trans men, trans folks, transgender folks.
Non-binary.
Actually, that we should probably define.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
What's non-binary?
Just somebody who identifies outside of the male-female binary view or man-woman binary view. It's just not in that two-box system. It's not just other. It has its own construct and makeup and expression and essence. And it may mean something different to each person who has a non-binary identity. So in this paper, those who have a more gender fluid or gender non-binary identity, there were two groups of individuals. One who took a more androgynous take on their identity, who mixed masculine and feminine expressions and dress style and self-concept, male and female mixed, masculine and feminine mixed self-concept, and made something either androgynous or new. And those who alternated, where they said, you know, I don't ascribe to any one of these two boxes. Sometimes I feel more male, sometimes I feel more female, sometimes I feel more masculine, sometimes I feel more feminine. And so they alternate their expressions depending on their feelings and how they want to express themselves in their world. So gender non-binary can be perhaps one of these two things. It could be a more androgynous approach or a new creation of identity outside of the two-sex system. And it can be sort of this more fluid change, like this day this, next day this, another day this.
How about genderqueer?
Again, all of these identities are not my own identity, so I am speaking for others based on what I have seen in the literature. I just want to make that very clear. It's important to me to say that out loud. But in my research, genderqueer has, again, as part of this similar expression, these two different expressions or these two different constructs or definitions. One is turning the traditional model on its head and saying, I am something new besides man or woman. I'm queering gender. I'm mixing something into something new, more androgynous or non-defined. And then there are those who say, I'm genderqueer, which means sometimes I express myself more masculine. Sometimes I express myself more feminine. Sometimes I mix it up and incorporate aspects of both.
What are some terms that may have been in use before and it was okay to use, and some people might still use them, and even some trans folks might use them to describe themselves, but in sort of general discourse have now fallen out of favor?
Oh, I am very conflicted about saying those words in such a venue, because they are
right.
They're not really welcome in most of the communities, and some folks who may still use those words, that's fine. They can use it for themselves. But I don't feel really comfortable repeating them if a community doesn't really feel like it's representative, because it would, for some people may have never heard those words before, and I don't want to introduce them.
Ooh, interesting. You don't think we should mention them in this context of words that people shouldn't be using?
No, I'd rather not. I'd rather just say this general principle, which is if somebody didn't tell you that's their identity, please don't use it. The community is moving away from using noun words for the community, such as transgenders. Please don't say that.
Right, so you can use transgender as an adjective, a transgender person,
right.
or transgender folks, but not transgenders.
That's right.
Okay.
It's so funny. I think back of like all the stupid things I've probably said in my life, and now it's just. I mean, I'm sure I'm not the only one, but I know personally. I'm sure some of the words you're probably leading to, Dr. John, I'm sure at one point in my life I've probably said them.
Oh yeah,
and you may have said them too.
Absolutely. A lot of us have.
And so, Seth, how do you? I mean, I know you're part of it is educating people, but outside of asking the name and everything like that, like how can people learn more? Like, is it as easy as, like, are the transgender community, can I walk up to a transgender woman and ask them questions? You know, I'm being serious, Dr. John. It's
That really depends.
Yeah.
You're asking a very, like, depending on where you're approaching this person.
Yeah.
Are you stopping someone on the street and saying,
Starbucks.
Huh, you look transgender to
not.
Me.
Yes.
Can I ask you some questions?
No, I'm just saying for the regular person who just doesn't, you know, who wants to do the right thing. You know, outside of, you know, Googling stuff about that, what are a couple things you can suggest to people who, you know, who have a transgender person in their life, you know, or meet someone who works with somebody?
So the first thing that I would say is pick up a memoir and read it. There are plenty of memoirs out there written by trans people about their lives, and that those are individuals who are willing to talk about their lives. In fact, they have chosen to write a book about it and make it very public. So support them, buy their book. Read it and get an insight as to what their life was like growing up and how they came to understand themselves as trans and how they decided to make a decision about what to do given that gender conflict and how to live authentically.
That's a great recommendation.
That would be a first.
Do you have any favorites?
Oh, yeah. Jameson Green has a book. Becoming a Visible Man is his book, his first book. And The Woman I Was Not Born to Be by Alicia Brevard is a really good book.
Awesome. We'll put links to both of those books in the episode description at the end.
There are a lot of newer books that are now more geared towards parents who have trans kids or kids who have parents who have come out in later life as trans and transition later life. So there are a lot of newer books on the market as well. I don't necessarily want to prioritize one over another, but those two books, Jameson Green's Becoming a Visible Man, almost anything by Leslie Feinberg, Stone Butch Blues, which
is a really difficult read.
But
yeah,
you know, there
I read
are
that
other
book when I was a
there.
Teenager, and yeah, that was a really formative book for me in many ways. Although that's in I think this is important to say that, you know, these are individual experiences, so it will give people a really in-depth look into the experience of that one person, but that doesn't mean that that's true of every other trans or non-binary person out there. And some of these, like Stone Butch Blues, that's about the lived experience a long time ago. I mean, at this point, a long time ago, right?
But it's actually, it's a long time ago, but that experience it still happens.
Right.
So we still see the kind of personal violations and societal discrimination that Leslie Feinberg talked about in Stone Butch Blues. That's still happening.
True.
And, you know, Jameson Greene coming out and being a masculine presenting individual a few decades ago, 70s and 80s or so, and then coming into himself in his adulthood is an excellent description of how what it was like being trans coming out just in the last 25 years.
The shifts.
The books. Exactly. And then Alicia Brevard's book of The Woman I Was Not Born to Be, it's also a very good narrative of what the experience was like for trans women coming out at the time that she was coming out in the last quarter century, in the last 25 years, right? And then, you know, if you pick up a book on the shelves today about parents who have trans kids, you'll see this is the shift in what we're seeing in society, that because there's more visibility, youth are not being rejected by their parents as much as they were 25 years ago. It still happens, but not hardly as much as it did 25 years ago. And so, you know, parents are starting to write books about their kids and kids are writing books about their own experience growing up in those families. And so we're hearing about it younger and younger and younger, which to me is awesome. And it also normalizes the experience for other youth that are going to follow in their footsteps.
And
well, Joe asked, you know, how do we find out about this stuff? And how do we, what do we do when we want to know more? So first thing, read a book. Second thing, get to know people. Make friends. When you start to build friendships in community with people who are trans, and you do that by showing support. How are you going to be friends with somebody if you don't support their way of life? Well, you read a book to get to know a little bit about them, to demystify all of the stereotypes and negative things that you've heard about them. Then go out into community and support them. Go to a rally. Go to a talk. Go to an event, a trans pride event, a trans remembrance event, and listen to the stories of the people who choose to hold the microphone at those events. Learn more about their lives in real time. And as you participate in community and support the community just by being present and open-hearted and open-minded, you will have the opportunity to say, hi, what's your name?
And, you know, even if you don't have access to some of these events, you know, if you don't live in New York and San Francisco where things are not as visible and prevalent as they are in some of these cities, but there's the internet. It's so easy these days to connect. You know, there are people on Instagram whose lives you can follow and learn from them and see how they live on a day-to-day basis and what they choose to post, you know, about their lives. There are articles being written. You know, there are magazines. Like I wrote a few articles for Them, where, you know, and Them, that entire publication is about queer and non-straight and non-cis folks. So there are lots of ways to learn about this and kind of follow what's happening. One thing, when you were talking about the nouns, kind of moving away from using nouns to refer to people and using them as adjectives, you know, we've had this phrase, sex assigned at birth or sex designated at birth. And I was at this conference, right, at Quares, and there was a conversation that was started because one of the presenters, he was looking at the prevalence of assigned female at birth folks who are identifying as trans or non-binary or some other kind of non-cis identification. And he kept saying they were females assigned at birth. They were females assigned at birth, females assigned at birth. And people had issue with that being used as a noun. They were like, why are you identifying these folks with the biological sex that they are trying to move away from? They have been trying to move away from their entire lives, and instead use it as an adjective. They were children assigned female at birth, or, you know, folks assigned female at birth. So even just that one letter, adding the S to the end of the word or not adding, can make a big difference in how it makes people feel.
Yeah, and you know what? From a developmental standpoint, when someone is coming out as trans or really struggling to figure out their identity and see, like, does this label fit them? It may be all encompassing, you know, like my life at the time that I was coming out was really just consumed by this identity development process, mm-hmm. right? But as you come to integrate it into who you are as a human being, then there's more space for you to be trans and a researcher and right. a partner and a brother and a son and things like that. So, you know, to limit somebody as a transgender, that's not all that they are. Mm. They are so much more than that.
Right.
And so really trans is just one piece of, it could be a big piece, but it's just one piece of who they are as human beings.
Right. Now I'm just realizing we're coming close to the kind of the end of the time that we have for this conversation, and we barely touched upon the study that you did. So we kind of talked about a lot of these things already, but let's just briefly kind of summarize what that was. So I already mentioned that you had 170 participants fill out an online survey and asking them about their gender identities, as well as their kind of gender presentation and other aspects of their gender lived experience. So tell us about some of the most common gender identities that were being picked by these people who were gender nonconforming in some way. What were the most common gender identities that you found in the sample?
So I recruited the sample by putting out a call for anybody who had been assigned female at birth who considered themselves gender nonconforming in some way. Mm-hmm. From that, I offered them an opportunity to pick from – I created a list of 30 terms. And how I got those terms was I went through as much literature as I could in identity literature, particularly gender and sexuality identity literature. And I picked out the top 30 terms. And I kept adding terms until I either had what's called saturation, which means I wasn't really finding anything new, or the term was just said, we don't use this anymore. But things like female, dyke, butch, androgynist, gender blender, sex radical, hermaphrodite or intersex, trans, cross-dresser. I mean, I had some archaic terms on here because I was going to be sampling from communities where they may have still used these terms. Mm-hmm. For example, transvestite, which we don't really use anymore. But like sissy male, femme male. And then I allowed people to really tell me what else. What did I miss? Mm-hmm. And so the most common terms that people selected from the list, and again, they could pick as many as they felt applied to them, were genderqueer, tranny boy, transgender, F to M or female to male, transsexual, and male. Now, those are the terms that were used at least 30% of the time or more. The most common term used was genderqueer. 89% of the sample selected the term genderqueer as one of their options. And of the 170 people who participated in the study, I got over almost 750 terms selected absolutely.
Wow. That's a lot.
Which means that it's a lot, which means on average, amongst this self-identified non-conforming community, they were using at least 4 terms to identify themselves. Hmm. Now, what that tells me as a researcher is, gosh, when you give someone 2 choices on a form, such as male and female, right. Boy, are you limiting their options.
Hmm. I've because never heard that phrase before, genderqueer, before.
I mean, never heard genderqueer
never in my life.
Before?
Never in my life. I know it's a stupid question, but I guess that's more common than I think, right?
No, but see, this is great. I love doing the podcast with Joe because—
I'm an idiot?
No, because you are representative of someone who doesn't live in these sex positive or sex activist or sex research or whatever bubbles that— You know, I live in, probably Seth lives in to a great extent, and we hear these terms so much, and we think everybody knows about this, right? And if you don't, then you must not have any access to the internet,
right?
You know, or you must live some like super sheltered, conservative life or something like that, and that's why you've never heard, or you've chosen not to hear. You know, you actively are against all of this, and that's why you've shielded yourself from this information. But you know, you're someone who like works on the radio.
Yeah, yeah. I've lived in New York City my entire life. Yeah, so
you read, you follow pop culture, follow pop media so much, and yet you've never heard some of these terms, and so that really tells us that this is not mainstream information yet.
Yeah. You know what I'll also say about genderqueer is that even though 88% of the sample selected genderqueer as one of the identity terms that they would use to describe themselves, not everybody uses it as their primary identification. So I'm not surprised, on some level, now that I think about it, I'm not surprised that you haven't heard genderqueer.
Okay.
Because even in a sample that I targeted who would be more likely to use this term, even among them, they don't all use the term as their primary term. So okay, unless you are intimately friends with someone who is in the trans community or who has, you know, associated themselves as or described themselves as gender nonconforming in some way, shape, or form, then you probably wouldn't come across it.
Right.
You know, a tomboy wouldn't go out of their way to just say, yeah, I'm genderqueer. But if really in conversation with someone who did use that term, somebody who really thought of themselves as a tomboy might be like, oh, yeah, if you put it that way, I queer gender.
I
challenge gender norms. You probably have seen it in other shapes and sizes and other terms used to describe it.
Just not
but without hearing
label.
Genderqueer itself. Yeah.
And so looking at all these different kind of labels that people use and the experiences that they shared as part of their gender, you kind of talked about two different groups of or types of gender identities, one that was more fixed and one that was more fluid. And so talk to us a little bit about these and which kind of subcategories fell under fixed versus fluid.
If I were to do this again, and I probably, because it's in press, I may have an opportunity with the editorial board or with the editorial staff to make this semantic change. You know, I might use phrases like those that are more binary and those that are more non-binary.
Okay.
Thinking about this more, that's really more of what I was getting at. And I didn't really have that clear in my mind yet when I put this pen to paper or ink to paper. and what I mean by that, the fixed and fluid or the binary and non-binary are in this sample. So everybody in this sample was assigned female at birth, and yet their current identities, their current gender identities were all over the place. They distilled into four general groups. The fixed group, those that I called the fixed group, or now what I would probably call a more binary-oriented group, are those who were, however nonconforming, but still cisgendered in that their gender identities were still in alignment with the sex they were assigned at birth, so they identified as women.
They were just tomboyish women.
Yeah, so they had identities that were most commonly described as female, woman, or girl. Their gender presentation was feminine or tomboyish. They played with their expressions, but even if they wore male clothing, they still used it to express their version of femininity. Their gender behavior was tomboyish, and some describe their behavior in being tomboyish as, I just don't do what's stereotypically feminine, but that doesn't mean that my behavior is not feminist or feminine, and that those two things are not the same, but the community was describing both of those things.
Right. So in some ways, they are broadening what a woman can be and can look like and can act like.
Exactly.
So they are still identifying as women, but saying, I can wear male clothing or short hair or whatever, and that's still part of being a woman kind of thing.
And I can play football or I can play, you know, sports that are stereotypically male-oriented.
No, and I can be a welder. You know, I don't know.
Yeah. And they also said, no, I'm not interested in having any surgeries. So,
which
they
makes
were not
sense.
Seeking any surgeries.
Right.
Yeah. And so the other fixed group or the other group that is in this binary model were those that identified as men or as males. And so words that they used to describe themselves were male, man, or trans man. They had a gender presentation that was masculine, like stereotypically masculine. Their gendered behavior, they described it in stereotypically male typed ways. And they, sort of a defining characteristic of this group, was that they were in some sort of active medical transition. Either they were on cross-sex hormones, they had a chest surgery to remove their breasts, they were seeking out genital surgeries to really live their lives as men and to be seen as men and to associate with their partners or other friends as men.
Right.
So those are the fixed groups or the binary groups.
So these are really just kind of men, people who are assigned female at birth, but they really felt like full-on typical guy. And
right.
they did or are doing whatever is necessary to change their body to look in line what they feel. And they are taking on all of the kind of the typical gender conforming in a way.
That's right.
Right. The roles for a man in our society.
That's right.
And many of them, as you said, don't even identify as trans. They just identify as men. Right.
That's right. That's right. Some of the people actually got mad in their responses. They were like, what the hell? You know. I don't even think about this anymore. I'm just a man.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So, you know, that's cool. I included their voices in this paper, which really made me happy.
Mm.
And then there's this fluid group or this non-binary group that had I really broke them into two different groups. And here are the distinguishing characteristics. So there's one that was traditionally gender non-binary, where their identities were described as non-binary, or they used the word androgynous. And the two presentations, similar to how I described before, were either alternating between masculine and feminine or some kind of blended androgynous presentation. Their gender behavior similarly was alternating between masculine and feminine or some sort of like androgynous behavior. And then a majority of these individuals described not seeking out any sort of sex reassignment or gender affirmation surgeries. They would say things though like, I wish I could just have a flat chest, or I wish sometimes I could just grow sideburns, but I don't want it to be permanent.
Right. Because that's kind of part of that shifting or alternating and fluidity,
yes.
Right?
That's right. And then there was within this fluid group, a group that I clustered as trans masculine, where although they had a more masculine oriented gendered identity, the trans aspect to that masculinity was very important.
Mm-hmm.
That people often described that although they thought of themselves as masculine or as trans masculine or even as F2M, for example, female to male or in a more trans male like presentation, they said, you know, on some level, I'm not exactly sure where I'm going to end up with my gender identity quite yet, but I do know that I'm not female. I don't identify as a girl, or I don't identify with my female sex assignment. So they were rejecting of that female sex assignment and moving towards something masculine, but not quite essentially male.
Right. Not all the way as the more fixed group.
In that sense. Mm. And so their gender presentation was trending towards masculine, although they did recognize that they did like to play with their expression. They did like to queer up or blend some sort of feminine components to a masculine predominant expression. Their gendered behavior similarly, where they are interested in breaking down some of the stereotypic masculine norms and saying, well, you know, I'm sensitive and I do like to wear lipstick sometimes, or I really like to express this more feminine aspect to myself, but I don't want to be seen as a woman, or I don't want to be seen as female. And so there was this, and a rejecting of a birth sex, the stuff that was associated, the gender that was associated with a birth sex assignment towards or trending masculine, but not fully stereotypically male in a binaried sense.
Right.
And a lot of individuals in this group, this transmasculine group, were actively considering pursuing some sort of medical intervention, whether it was hormones or just chest surgery, but not feeling too much pressure around having any sort of genital surgery,
right.
or you know, they weren't really attached to being male in society. They were attached to being seen as using male pronouns or as being seen as masculine, but that they were still willing to play with their gender.
A little bit, right. Fascinating. Is there something like this for kids or, at this point, adults who are assigned male at birth who are gender nonconforming and kind of these different identities? Did you collect any data on?
Yes. So I do have data on men, but I'm in the process of analyzing it. This stuff takes a while.
Cool. I'm looking forward to seeing and reading that, and we'll have you back on the podcast to talk about that whole group. And thank you so much for being on the Science of Sex podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, I feel enlightened, Dr. Jana.
Good. Good. Yeah. I'm glad that these conversations can enlighten you and
enlighten me. Yes.
Enlighten you.
Yes.
Can enlighten you and hopefully, I mean, this is a process of learning, right?
Yeah.
And continually learning and getting better and figuring out how to be better, how to be more inclusive, how to be more, as Seth was saying, kind and compassionate to people who are marginalized and ostracized and ignored.
And Seth was really nice to me. You did roll your eyes at me a couple times. Don't worry, I did see that. I did like you.
I was like, "Oh my god! Did you just say that? Did you just ask that?"
Why? Well, I mean, you're.
But no, I'm glad. Yeah. I'm glad that you did because
yes.
If you have those questions, many of our listeners have those questions too. And as became very obvious, a lot of these things that I might think, "Oh my god, everybody knows this."
Yeah.
Obviously, no, not everybody,
not everybody
knows this.
No.
Mm-hmm. So. And I know. You know, maybe our listeners don't, but I know you're not a dick, and you're not actively trying to be insulting or offensive to anybody, but you just might not have some of the information that you need to have in order to, use the language the way we're using it nowadays.
Yeah, and it's funny because he did mention a lot of times if you're in that community, you will know the proper phrases, proper words to use, whereas I don't have a lot of friends in the trans community, not because I'm just avoiding them. It's just I just don't have any in my life. I've got a pretty simple ass life. I don't get out much.
They don't have trans people in Jersey.
They do, but you know what? Listen, when I go to Jersey, I go home. I watch some Netflix, and and then I come into work the next day. You know what I mean? So, but it's like I think I told you a few months ago. You know, I didn't meet my first gay person until I was in college.
Yeah.
So it's just like one of those things where it's like once you meet the person, then you learn and you learn the proper things. Like back then I said stupid things that gay people don't accept, or maybe they were acceptable then, but are not acceptable now. So this is all part
we
of the science of sex. We live and learn, Dr.
Absolutely.
Jana. And now what are we going to live and learn next week?
Ooh, next week we're going to have Dr. Liam Wignall from Bournemouth University in the UK, who's going to talk to us about pup play.
I'm sorry, what?
Puppy play.
Interesting.
Yeah,
you.
It's a kink. It's a fetish.
And you're not a dog person, so. So
look,
how did this get by?
I like dogs. I just don't want to live with the dog or take care of a dog. Now, a human dog. Now, that's a whole other story.
Yeah, okay.
The human dog can do a lot of things that a canine dog cannot you have to do for them, and that's really my issue with
real dogs.
With real dogs.
Yeah, okay. Well, you might get enlightened next week then, it sounds
I think we all will. But yeah, so this is someone who's been studying this community, this kinky interest, and he's going to talk to us about that research.
Cool. Well, that wraps up episode number 50, or 50, as we say in Spanish.
50.
Yeah.
Really? Since when do you speak Spanish?
Well, you know, I'm Spanish. I just don't speak it.
Right.
But yeah. That's 50. But in the meantime, check out our website, thescienceofsexpodcast.com. That's where you can get a hold of us. That's where you can catch up on old episodes.
That's where you can read up the episode recaps, follow all the links. So we're going to put up, for this episode, we're going to put up the links to the books that Seth was talking about, as well as the research that is coming out. Yeah, you can learn more about our guests. You can get all the information about all the events that we do, all the discount codes that we might have for their sponsors. So, yes, please do check out our website and write to us.
Info@scienceofsexpodcast.com is the email, or you can get that right on the website, scienceofsexpodcast.com. Dr. Jana, till next time.
Bye, Joe.
Bye.
To connect with Dr. Jana and Joe, go to thescienceofsexpodcast.com or follow us on Twitter @scienceofsexpod and follow us on Facebook @The Science of Sex Podcast. Subscribe now to listen to the weekly podcast.